Sphinx Bio develops computational tools to accelerate scientific discovery. The company is focused on addressing the computational data analysis bottleneck by enabling scientists to do the analysis themselves. Nicholas Laura Stone is the founder of Sphinx. He joins the show to talk about being a computer scientist at the interface with biology, the data analysis bottleneck in biology, designing a software tool for scientists, their go-to-market strategy, and more. Nicholas also started Bits in Bio, which is a popular community for people building software for science. You can check out their upcoming meetups and hackathons at bitsinbio.org. This episode of Software Engineering Daily is hosted by Sean Falconer. Check the show notes for more information on Sean's work and where to find him.
Nicholas, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, thanks so much for being here. So you are the founder of Sphinx Bio and the creator of Bits in Bio. But when I was doing some digging into your background, I saw that your education is in computer science. So I guess, like, how did this crossover into biology actually start?
Yeah, so I've been interested in bio for quite some time. I actually worked in a lab in high school over the summer, and I'd say, you know, always had these dual interests of computer science, biology. And then when I got to college, I, you know, took bio classes, I took CS classes, and just enjoyed doing the CS homework more. So, you know, I continued to work in labs in my undergrad and my master's, but just felt like I actually liked writing code more. And the more time I spent in labs, the more I found that I wasn't actually great at the wet lab part of it, the actual, like, physical manual labor there. And so, you know, have been fortunate enough to, like, find myself at this intersection where I can do what I like, which is writing code and building software, but apply it to a domain that I'm really interested in, which is science.
Yeah, amazing. And then I guess as you're, like, you know, building out a company in the space, you can have, if you need a wet lab, you can hire people to do that part that are maybe more interested and enjoy it. Yeah, I found when I was doing my computer science degree, you know, I took, like, physics classes and I took, you know, chemistry classes. And I think the, like, unappealing side of sort of the physical sciences for me was just, I found the labs just, like, super lengthy, and I was just, like, kind of not engaged. Even though I could spend, like, hours in front of my computer actually coding, I don't know, that was just somehow more enjoyable and felt like less of a waste of time than spending hours in, like, a lab on campus. For some reason, it just didn't jive with me.
That means you found what you're excited about, right? I've worked with scientists who kind of look back fondly at their PhDs when they're doing 12, 14 hour time courses in the lab, and they have to be in the lab doing something every 30 minutes. And so I think to me, it was just a good signal that, okay, I don't want to be a kind of, like, hands-on biologist. I'd much rather be a computer scientist, software engineer, because, like you, I'd much rather, you know, spend hours building something out of software than spend hours sitting in the lab pipetting liquids around.
Yeah, as well, it's good that you were able to recognize that about yourself as well. So tell me about Sphinx Bio. Like, what is it and what problem are you trying to solve?
We're a software platform for scientists at biotech companies to manage and analyze their data. And the core problem that we're working on solving is this idea of an analysis bottleneck, which is where you can run experiments in the lab, but you're actually waiting on the results of your analysis of the data. And that, in my view, should never happen, right? Like, the hard part is actually doing the experiment in the lab. And so what we see here is that the data is maybe complex to analyze, or it takes a long time to actually gather both the data from the experiment as well as all the kind of context around that experiment. Or you have to wait for someone who knows how to code in order to analyze that data. And so we give the tools to scientists to actually do that analysis themselves in a streamlined, easy manner so that they don't have to spend time waiting. They can spend their time actually doing science, which is what they're paid to do and what they like to do.
What's the main bottleneck? What stops the flow of data getting to them for analysis?
So sometimes it's actually depends on the type of experiment, but sometimes it's they don't have the, like, capabilities to analyze that because the tools that they're often trained with are Excel, some other kind of, like, older legacy applications as well, which might not be a good fit for the more modern experiments that they're doing. So that's, like, one one barrier to entry, I would say. Another barrier is maybe not that they can't do it, but that, you know, each analysis takes, you know, a couple of hours to do, and they're running, you know, dozens of these experiments a week, right? And so they just don't have the time to do it. And so if we can take that down from, hey, I have this 12-tab Excel sheet that takes me a couple hours to analyze, to, hey, I can do this in Sphinx in 5 minutes, then we can actually remove the bottleneck of like piling up of old experiments. And then the last piece is, a lot of experiments in science are run by an individual, but the context might be shared across a company, right? And so if you are testing, if you're trying to design a new drug and you're testing a specific molecule that you've designed, the analysis of that molecule is important to put in the context of everyone else who's tested it. And you might not have access to that data, either from a permissioning perspective or from just they did this only on their computer and it wasn't shared with anyone else. And so we work hard to try and bring that shared experimental context to everyone as well.
What's the data actually look like? What is kind of the shape of the data that comes out of these experiments?
It's wide ranging. It depends on the experiment. We work with mostly tabular or semi-structured data is how I would describe it. There are other companies who do a lot with sequencing data or imaging data. We've kind of deliberately stayed away from those domains to start. But these often look like, again, pretty messy Excel spreadsheets. When you're thinking Excel spreadsheet, you might think of something that a human has designed with, you know, reasonably named columns and data and all of the rows. Oftentimes, these are not that. They're coming off machines where it's laid out in kind of a visual manner to make it easy for a scientist to look at, but it's not great for software to analyze that. And so there is a large piece of our platform that we do in order to help kind of standardize and harmonize that data. And sometimes we do get kind of CSVs, TSVs, a little bit more friendly formats that you can just upload and start working with right away.
As a listener of Software Engineering Daily, you understand the impact of generative AI. On the podcast, we've covered many exciting aspects of Gen AI technologies, as well as the new vulnerabilities and risks they bring. HackerOne's AI red teaming addresses the novel challenges of AI safety and security for businesses launching new AI deployments. Their approach involves stress testing AI models and deployments to make sure they can't be tricked into providing information beyond their intended use, and that security flaws can't be exploited to access confidential data or systems. Within the HackerOne community, over 750 active hackers specialize in prompt hacking and other AI security and safety testing. In a single recent engagement, a team of 18 HackerOne hackers quickly identified 26 valid findings within the initial 24 hours and accumulated over 100 valid findings in the two-week engagement. HackerOne offers strategic flexibility, rapid deployment, and a hybrid talent strategy. Learn more at hackerone.com/AI. That's HackerOne.com/AI.
So how do you go from this kind of semi-structured tabular format data into something that's actually standardized? That presumably, I'd love to get into sort of like what's happening behind the scenes, but that probably ends up in some sort of like structured data store somewhere, you know, behind the scenes, so that you can actually provide tooling to perform the analysis down the road as the scientist is interacting with the product.
Maybe answering that last piece first, we do make everything tabular at the end of the day to fit with existing analysis tools. And this maps pretty well onto what scientists do. They just typically do it by hand, right? So people are literally copying and pasting values from, you know, one Excel sheet into another. And that's not great because there's often mistakes made in that transcription. And it's also extremely time consuming and painful. And so what we do on the kind of like turning semi-structured into structured side is we first start by seeing if it's like an experiment type that we're familiar with, essentially. And so we basically pattern match to figure out, okay, do we have a clean deterministic way to do this? We've built out some state machines on the back end actually to help parse that data. And then at the the end of the day, there's a lot of machines out there that are producing data in a lot of different formats. And so we know we, as a small startup, can't capture everything. And so we've started looking into using LLMs to help parse some of that semi-structured data and turn it into these structured tables that we can use for downstream analysis.
In terms of the pattern recognition that you're doing, is that sort of like basically you're applying different heuristics to identify the patterns in the data, or are you doing something more complicated using like a machine learning and some sort of like classification engine?
No, I mean, heuristics and asking users are the two main ways. So we will ask for some user input on kind of more complex tasks, but we do use heuristics. Like, one, maybe to give a concrete example, we work a lot with plate data. So plates are a type of experimental setup in biology where you have like a physical matrix of different wells. Each well contains either an experiment or a part of an experiment in it. And so that data often comes back in a matrix format. It might not be neatly returned in a matrix format. There's a lot of data around that that we can use to help identify where that plate is. So one heuristic would be, we know what the sizes of plates are. And so if the matrix matches that size, that's a pretty good indicator that we have plate-based data that we can then turn into a more structured data source.
This episode of Software Engineering Daily is brought to you by Vantage. Do you know what your cloud bill will be for this month? For many companies, cloud costs are the number two line item in their budget and the number one fastest growing category of spend. Vantage helps you get a handle on your cloud bills with self-serve reports and dashboards built for engineers, finance, and operations teams. With Vantage, you can put costs in the hands of the service owners and managers who generate them, giving them budgets, alerts, anomaly detection, and granular visibility into every dollar. With native billing integrations with dozens of cloud services, including AWS, Azure, GCP, Datadog, Snowflake, and Kubernetes, Vantage is the one FinOps platform to monitor and reduce all your cloud bills. To get started, head to vantage.sh. Connect your accounts and get a free savings estimate as part of a 14-day free trial.
Okay, so once you first perform some of the pattern recognition to figure out what kind of data that you're dealing with, what happens next? What's sort of this whole like pipeline that's going on behind the scenes?
Yeah, so what happens next is, once we figure out where the data is, essentially, we can then, in this case of the plate-based data, for instance, we can then convert that into a like true tabular format. And so we'll do that on the back end. And then we bring up a confirmation for our users to say, hey, here's what we were able to identify and here's what it's going to look like. Does that make sense? And then if they say that looks good, give us the go ahead, we'll store that and save that as in its structured form for them.
You also mentioned that you're now exploring using LLMs to do some of the pattern recognition on essentially situations where you might not know the signature of the tool or the signature of the data. Can you talk a little bit about what the work that you're doing there? Like, what's that sort of LLM tool chain look like?
So we released an open source package called PlateChain a few weeks ago, which uses LangChain, the kind of popular open source toolkit, pretty heavily. And so what we've done there is provided a set of examples for people to work off, first of all. Second of all, an actual chain in the terms of LangChain that will take in this kind of semi-structured data and output coordinates, essentially, of where the structured data is, which you can then build the kind of like back end of that, which is taking those coordinates and using that to extract the data and do whatever you want downstream. For us, that's turning into a structured table. Other people might have different use cases. And so I don't know how sophisticated our LLM setup is in comparison to some of these others, but we're pretty heavy LangChain users in terms of using their LangChain expression language. We have a demo with them of setting this up as API server so people can, you know, deploy this in their lab if they want to do this for all of their experiments. And then, of course, we use them for evaluation as well, because in our case, the experimental setups change pretty often for our customers. And so it's important to tell if an experimental setup changes, is our prompt still going to work here? you know, I think a lot of the magic there actually is in some of the prompting logic and the basically like rules that we give the LLM to help it identify where the plate-based data is.
How long did it take to figure out sort of the right combination of prompts to get what you needed?
I mean, it's definitely been an iterative process. I think it, honestly, just a couple of weeks of playing around with it, not full-time, of course, but just kind of end-to-end. It's been pretty stable in terms of prompts. There's been minor tweaks here and there, but we're able to figure this out pretty quickly. It's not perfect. We're always looking for new contributors and people who want to help out there, but we haven't done extensive prompt engineering in comparison because, you know, it actually works pretty well for the use cases that we've been applying it to.
WorkOS is a modern identity platform built for B2B SaaS. It provides seamless APIs for authentication, user identity, and complex enterprise features like SSO and SCIM provisioning. It's a drop-in replacement for Auth0 and supports up to 1 million monthly active users for free. It's perfect for B2B SaaS companies frustrated with high costs, opaque pricing, and lack of enterprise capabilities supported by legacy Auth vendors. The APIs are flexible and easy to use, designed to provide an effortless experience from your first user all the way to your largest enterprise customer. Today, hundreds of high-growth scale-ups are already powered by WorkOS, including ones you probably know, like Vercel, Webflow, and Loom. Check out workos.com/SED to learn more.
Do you think without being able to use something like LLMs and prompt engineering, like solving this problem would be possible?
It's theoretically possible. It's just very hard. So there are other companies in this space. TetraScience and Ganymede are two of the kind of newer ones who build what are called instrument connectors. And so what they have to do is they have to go and figure out how many instruments there are and figure out what those like instrument formats are, and then they build connectors for each and every one of those. And let me tell you, there's a very long tail of instruments in the biological space. And so they end up having to hire massive implementation teams to do all that. And so, as again, we're a pretty small startup, we can't build connectors for thousands and thousands of instruments. And so we use this as a good catch-all. And I'm excited to think about more use cases where you can apply LLMs in this way, right? It's not a perfect solution. It doesn't do everything for you, but it can get you pretty far without having to hire, you know, hundreds of engineers to build all this for you.
Yeah. Even if you did get to a place where you were building out some of these integrations, I would think that even leveraging LLMs could be a way to sort of like fast track that, because it's going to give you insight into how to do like the pattern recognition step that you need to do and actually maybe help you, you know, develop some of these like heuristics or algorithms that you need to actually do the less expensive non-GPU based pattern recognition to figure out the data structure.
It's interesting you say that. I feel like a lot of the prompts came out of the heuristics we had built, but I can imagine going the other way too, right? Where you could just, you know, as you work on the prompt, that actually kind of tells you a little bit about the heuristics you should be building and turning into more deterministic code as well.
So besides PlateChain, I know that you also have a product or a feature that is focused on like the folding playground. Yeah. So I guess to start with, like, why is the comparison between folding models like an important problem to solve?
Yeah, maybe just to take a step back about like what is a folding playground and what is protein folding. So the core problem here is we have a lot of amino acid sequences, so protein sequences, and we often don't know what the 3D structure is. To actually experimentally determine that is quite expensive. And so about 3 years ago now, DeepMind from Google came up with this algorithm called AlphaFold, which, depending on who you ask, more or less solved this problem. They basically got an accuracy that was almost as good as experimental determination in a lot of different use cases. And this is way better than anything that people had developed before. And so that unlocked the floodgates for structural biology, and a lot of new use cases in this area rely on using AlphaFold or some folding algorithm to take a sequence and turn it into a structure. And so what we found is as we were working with some more customers who were interested in these types of pipelines, they would make statements like, well, we have to use ESMFold, which is a different algorithm, because this is an orphan protein and it's going to work better for that. And then we'd hear other customers say the opposite, right? Like AlphaFold actually works better in this use case. And so what it kind of became clear to us is that people didn't have good basis for making these statements. And I think at least part of the reason was it's a bit of a pain to set up all of these tools and to compare them effectively. And so that's why we wanted to launch the Folding Playground, is to give people a way to answer those questions themselves. You know, with all the other LLMs, there's been a lot of LLM playgrounds and ways to compare, hey, which model actually works best for me? I think in bio, that's equally, if not more important, because a lot of these models, which are fairly general in theory, turn out to work much better on certain sub-problems than others. And so we want to make sure that scientists are using the right tool for the job, and we want to make it accessible to them. And that was the goal behind the Folding Playground.
And the value of understanding the 3D structure in the context of something like drug design, it gives you insights essentially how it might bond to the protein. Is that right? And in its effectiveness or its level of activity?
Yeah, so there's a couple of different ways that this could be useful. So one is actually if you're trying to make a drug against a certain protein, oftentimes you might not have a structure of that protein that you're trying to make a drug against. There's a bunch of techniques that you can use once you have a structure. Now, there's been some recent work that shows that the AlphaFold predicted structures still aren't quite good enough to make use of some of these other structure-based methods. And so more often what people use it for is what you're saying. If you're making a protein drug, then that as part of that kind of design pipeline, you'll use the structure prediction as basically a measure of fitness of whether or not you think this drug that you're making is going to fold into a real protein or whether it's just going to be like a mess of goop essentially. And so this has become very common in the kind of like protein design world, is using these folding methods as a filter step.
And then for the different techniques or like modeling techniques for creating these 3D structure, what tends to cause the variance in terms of the predicted 3D structures?
So some of them have pretty big like discrepancies in design. The main one is some of these are MSA enabled versus not MSA enabled. So MSA stands for multiple sequence alignment. And so this is what the original AlphaFold algorithm brought, which is it looks at a database of kind of all known protein sequences, and it takes your input sequence and it aligns it against those databases. And it uses that as kind of a good initialization step, let's think of it, to help design that 3D structure. But some of these other algorithms like ESMFold, like OmegaFold, don't do that step at all. They're just trained on sequences. And so they're actually much faster to run inference. But the concern is that they're less grounded in biological reality, and therefore their performance is worse. And so, you know, there have been a number of papers that have come out with these different techniques. And so there's kind of more coming out all the time. DeepMind keeps releasing improvements there. We think they're significantly different enough that it's worth comparing them on your specific problem.
Mm-hmm. And then what are some of the other areas that you're focused on in terms of improving where there are like bottlenecks kind of in the analysis process when it comes to like biologists and being able to do their work?
Yeah, some of the kind of more concrete experiment types that we work a lot with are qPCR. So for a number of RNA therapeutics companies, so think Moderna, for instance, they'll often run qPCR, which is quantitative PCR, polymerase chain reaction, where they're trying to get a number, a quantitative readout on expression of RNA. And so one of our kind of core workflows is helping scientists calculate the fold change of their qPCR experiment. So seeing, hey, I've designed this RNA therapeutic, this drug, I'd like to see how much better it is than a known therapeutic that has this amount of expression. And so streamlining that is a bit different than the folding protein problem, but we think fits in the same overall paradigm of making these tools accessible to scientists.
How do you figure out where to like make these investments that could have meaningful impact. Are you doing like, you know, conducting essentially like user studies with different labs, or are you doing this based on your own experience and other people at the company's experience?
It's a combination of both. So, you know, I've spent the last several years working at drug discovery companies and, you know, building these types of tools internally. And so there's definitely a lot that is drawn from what I've built and seen there. And then a lot of it is also kind of in concert with users. So we have a number of design partners who we work closely with. And I think the nice kind of happy middle that we've found is a lot of the core ideas have come from my previous experiences and the team's previous experiences working with these types of companies. And then the specific implementation is best done hand in hand with the actual users for their specific experiments. And so that's been where we've found the most success so far. And, you know, we're always looking to talk to more people and meet new users and hear about their use cases, but it's a combination. I don't think you can do just one or just the other. It really has to be talking to users and then using your own kind of intuition here.
Mm-hmm. And then how do you actually, you know, test that you're moving in the right direction? Are you building sort of like a minimal viable products? Like what is sort of the design process to actually make sure that you're learning? Like I would think that, you know, one of the hard things about like go to market or product development in the space is just the learning cycles are potentially slower than they might be when you think about like a traditional B2C product that you might be just putting out there on Twitter and hoping that people engage with.
Yeah, I think the cycles are definitely long. Biotech is a slow industry. I mean, it takes 10 to 15 years to get a drug approved. And so when the companies are thinking at that time scale, it definitely trickles down even into their software buying practices. So I think it requires us to have a bit of patience. It requires us to have conviction. And yeah, it's not necessarily that you can ship a lean startup MVP, you know, on Twitter, see if anyone gives you feedback. I think it requires us to, you know, work really closely with the design partners we have and try and build conviction with them. And then also look for other, maybe noisier signals around, hey, if we're pitching to a new client, do they seem really excited by this when we give them access to it? Where are they spending their time in the application? But yeah, I think it's hard to just apply the traditional Silicon Valley playbook here. I don't think that's been very successful in the space, but yeah, it's a combination of all of those things. I'm sorry if that's a waffling answer, but that's the reality for us.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't feel like a move fast, break things kind of, you know, go to market or product building experience. Actually, I want to talk a little bit about the company and your journey as a founder. So the company's been around for a little over a year. And first off, speaking as a former founder myself, like founder years are like dog years. So how's it been being a founder of a company? What's that experience been like for you?
I mean, it's been really good. It's something that, you know, I'm excited by. I have been working in this space for a long time. So like, I care very deeply about this problem and seeing this problem solved. And, you know, we had the opportunity to raise a seed round earlier this year and build out a team. And so that's been really fun. I think it's also been hard as well. Biotech's going through a bit of a rough patch, to be honest. There's been a lot of layoffs. And so it feels like the industry is moving especially slowly. I think the upside to that is it really forces us to build something useful, right? Like there's not a lot of kind of money floating around. And so when we have conviction in something, it's going to be a much deeper conviction than we might have had in 2021. But, you know, I think it's been a whirlwind year. Dog years is a great way to describe it. I think it's been really cool to see the progress, both in the team side and the product side. And we're never moving quite as fast as we want to, but I think you got to take both the ups and the downs.
Yeah, I think that's probably something that every founder, anybody involved in an early stage company always feels like they're moving quite as fast. Things always take longer, or they feel like they take longer than they really should, but it's just, you know, it's hard to build companies and build them successfully. I do think, you know, what you're saying in terms of there's not necessarily a lot of money floating around and so forth, and you have to be really intentional about what you're investing in. Now, the good thing about that is that I think some of the best companies in history have always have come out of these like downturns in the market, because it does force you to focus and really figure out what's working and what's not working, and be somewhat conservative maybe in types of investments that you're making. So you raised a round earlier this year, a seed round. What is the size of the company today? How are things structured?
Yeah, so right now there's three of us. We have a fourth joining early next year. We're all engineers. We're all technical. So it's a very flat structure. We all work together, you know, work in a pretty collaborative manner, I would say. I spend a fair amount of my time doing the, I guess, less technical aspects of building the business, right? So doing the sales and product work, but we all sit in the same room. We're all in person in San Francisco, sitting around a table, writing on whiteboards and working together.
And then what's the actual tech stack behind the product today?
Yeah, so we have a Next.js front end and then basically all Python on the back end for a combination of ML and bio libraries. Actually, there's a bunch of scientific libraries written in Python. So fast API for our server. We use Temporal for some of our longer running job queues. And then we use Modal for our GPU kind of ML jobs, as well as some kind of parallelization of kind of massive jobs as well.
Fantastic. Yeah, I talked to the founder of Temporal recently on the show. So
that's very
great.
Cool.
That's a great product. So it's great to see that you're incorporating it. Yeah, I would think like there's probably a lot of, when you're talking about data analysis and so forth, you're going to have a lot of these kind of traditionally asynchronous, like long running jobs that would become a nightmare to try to manage through, I don't know, cron jobs or something like that. Right.
Yeah, no, that would be a nightmare. Yeah, there's definitely a lot that I think one of the interesting things about the kind of bio space is that it is much more of a batch processing world than a stream processing world. And so, yeah, we do have a lot of kind of asynchronous long running jobs that would be a nightmare to manage in pure cron. And so definitely need some sort of kind of task queue behind us. And Temporal has been nice in terms of a lot of the DevEx around retries and being able to deal with flakes as well.
Is it hard to recruit engineering talent that can work in a biotech startup?
I think it's always hard to recruit good engineering talent. I think, yeah, it is challenging. You know, I don't think as many engineers are open to the idea of working in the bio space as they should be. So our kind of philosophy here is you don't need to have a bio background in any way, shape, or form to be valuable here. You know, most of the work that we do is just software engineering, right? And you need to be a good engineer to be productive. But what is important, I think, is to have an interest in the space, right? Because you're going to learn some biology whether you want to or not. And so if you're not excited by that, then it's probably not a good fit. And so I think that's like a good rule of thumb for any kind of vertical software company in this space is you generally don't need a bio background actually to be productive here, but you should be excited by the space and interested in it. And I think more engineers should be excited and interested in this space. It's kind of clear, positive impact, really interesting technical problems, and you can still build software, right? Like we're a software company. We don't have a wet lab or anything like that. At the end of the day, we make money by selling software tools.
Do you think that it's also in some ways like a relatively greenfield space when it comes to like technology innovation from like a software sense? Like are these labs that are being run, are they using sort of the most like cutting edge software, or are they a little bit behind when it comes to software innovation in comparison to maybe like a SaaS company or something like that?
Yeah, I think in general, you're right. They're a little behind. It depends on the lab. There's some very technically sophisticated companies and labs out there who are using the cutting edge tooling, but there's kind of far more biotech companies and labs, which might not be using kind of any software tooling at all, right? A lot of the companies out there have very minimal kind of computational expertise is what we would say, and you know, might not have any software engineers on their staff at all. Maybe they have some PhD bioinformaticians who are working with them, but they're probably not thinking about software in the same way that, you know, a software engineer in tech would be. So there's definitely that aspect of it. What I would say is it's not just about having the more modern technology though. Like you really do have to solve an important problem for scientists. I think scientists are amazing users. They're highly technical. They're working on really interesting problems, but they're not generally the most enthusiastic new adopters, unlike a lot of developers. And so they're great loyal users if you can prove to them that you're adding value, but it can be hard to convince them to try a new tool. So, you know, they don't care that we're using Temporal or, you know, any new piece of technology. What they care about is, are we solving an important problem for them?
So what is like go-to-market look like in this space though? Like, how do you reach those scientists? You know, it's not a, I assume, buy some ads on Google and they're, you know, people are, the scientists are, you know, writing their queries on Google to try to find a software solution to this. You probably have to meet them where they are and get in front of them in order for them to even understand that they can, you know, solve whatever problem they need to solve through something that you can offer them.
Yeah, it's a pretty traditional enterprise sales process. You know, we do try and talk to individual scientists at companies to get feedback on the product. That's important product feedback from us, but generally the purchasing decisions of these companies are coming from the executive level. And so that does lend itself to a much more traditional enterprise sales process. I'd say for me, a lot of the go-to-market has been through my personal network and, you know, from working at these companies and kind of meeting scientists and engineers who have gone off to work or start different companies. And then also through a community that I started called Bits and Bio has allowed me to meet people at all sorts of different biotech companies. And so far our go-to-market has been very network-driven, I would say.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, for the stage that you're at, where you're also probably making a lot of these folks like design partners, so you can figure out what it is that you need to build in unison with hopefully solving a problem for them.
Yeah, I'd say the one company who's had something like a product-led growth motion in this space has been Benchling. So they're kind of the most modern big company in this space. They started about 10 years ago, and they gave away their kind of initial product for free to academics. And we're able to get a lot of usage and product feedback that way. But then if you look at them today or even, you know, a bit earlier, it is still traditional enterprise sales into these biotech companies.
Yeah. Do you think that there's unique tooling that needs to be built for software engineers that are working on biotech software?
So I would say there's unique tooling that needs to be built for scientists. I don't agree that there needs to be unique tooling for software engineers. So I've been a software engineer in biotech, and we also use kind of like best-in-class tooling. You know, we're on Kubernetes and use Kubeflow for some of our ML inference when I was at Benevolent. You know, I brought in Daxter when I was at Octant. And so I think the challenge of trying to build vertical-specific tooling for developers in this space is that they have access to kind of best-in-class tooling and can customize that tooling with code to help them on whatever the task that they're trying to solve. Now, the one potential exception here is bioinformatics pipelines. And so there's a number of players in this space who are building very specific tooling for bioinformaticians. And I think that's a reasonable area to build in. But in general, I'm a bit more skeptical of people building tools for bio developers, because oftentimes just the best tool for that task is going to be enough.
So you mentioned Bits and Bio, which is a community for people building software in science. What inspired you to kind of start that community?
Yeah, so I was at Benevolent AI, which is a computational drug discovery company. It was a few hundred people by the time I left and very tech heavy. We had a really strong engineering team, ML engineering team, ML research team. And so I felt like I had a community where I could go talk to coworkers about, you know, which bioinformatics pipeline should we use or what LIMS vendors are we excited about. And then I went to Octant, which was a smaller startup when I joined. I was the first software engineer there. We had two bioinformaticians and didn't really have those people I could go to and ask those questions of. And so coming out of the pandemic, I'd seen a few other Slack communities in the health tech space that I was inspired by. And I thought, well, why don't we have this in the biotech space? So just posted on Twitter and said, hey, who's interested in this? I'm going to start a Slack community. And then people started joining and it's kind of taken off from there.
So how big is it? What's it look like?
Yeah, so we have almost 5,500 members now in the past 2 years. So we've grown quite a bit, which has been exciting. And We're organized around an online Slack community. Everyone should join. It's bitsandbio.org. And then we also have in-person meetups in cities all across the world. So I think we're up to 12 or 13 cities, mostly in North America and Europe, but we've been growing that as well. So we're likely to open up a Bits and Bio chapter near you soon enough.
Fantastic. And is there one in the Bay Area, I'm assuming?
Yeah, a big one in the Bay Area. We do events about once a month, I would say. Anything from just kind of networking, meeting other people in the space, to panels, lightning talks, hackathons. So once you join the Slack, we have location-specific channels that people can join and learn about the events that are near them.
Awesome. And then as we start to wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to share?
I'd say you asked a question earlier about software engineers getting into bio. I recently wrote a blog post talking about how you don't need a bio background to get into bio as an engineer. And I think this podcast is a great audience to try and promote that to. There's a lot of open problems in bio. It's incredibly impactful. We're working with companies who are trying to develop life-saving drugs or develop new materials to, you know, help with the climate crisis. And so I would encourage everyone who's, you know, maybe thought about bio, excited about bio, to either reach out to me or reach out to friends who are in the bio space and figure out where their talents can be best applied. Because, you know, they say the 21st century is going to be the century of biology, and you'd rather join early than late.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I think that we are sort of, it does feel like we're on the cusp of like major, major impactful innovation happening in biotech, whether it's, you know, drug design or some of the other things that are happening in computational biology. And I think it is a really exciting time to be in biology, even if it might feel like there's some resourcing constraints like going on. I don't think that's going to last, especially with everything that we're seeing from the world of Gen AI too, and the potential impact that it can have on some of the hard problems that exist in biology.
Yeah, I mean, super excited by Gen AI as like a process enabler, right? We talked about extracting semi-structured data, and then also the models, right? Like those model architectures translate to bio, right? That's the kind of like folding playground that we were talking about earlier as well. So it's definitely an exciting time to be in bio. And yeah, all those advances we see in the tech industry are going to make their way to bio and accelerate that process as well.
Awesome. Well, Nicholas, thanks so much for coming on and talking about your work at Sphinx and being an early stage founder. I'm sure you have a million things going on, so I appreciate you taking time to share your journey and share your vision for the company.
No, thanks for having me. This was great. Always happy to chat.
All right. Thank you. Cheers.
Thank you. All right.